Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It's finally time. I've completed The Legend of Zelda Tears of the Kingdom and can tell you all about it. This is VGC, a video game podcast with me, Jordan Midler, Chris Scullion, and Pete Donaldson. How are we doing, folks? Chris, welcome back from your sabbatical. How does it feel to be back in the world of the rat race of games journalism?
It's lovely. It's good to be back, especially good to be back in such short notice, because up until 3 minutes ago, I was transcribing a Japanese interview, and then all of a sudden I'm hauled in here as the substitute with no priming, no like research or anything. So this will be a fun one.
You got your cannabine, bro. Don't worry about it.
It's my brain juice.
That's one thing they say about Chris Scullion. He can broadcast on a moment's notice.
He is, yeah.
Famously.
He's like those kind of blokes that are position their camera outside a third floor North Korean hotel window, broadcasting for CNN. And they've just been walking up and they've had to put their trousers, they're not wearing trousers, but they put their suit and shirt on their top off just for it.
That is my strategy. I point the camera towards a window and the microphone towards a giant fan. So if anyone hears that, that'll be why.
And of course, you never wear trousers when it's time to broadcast.
Oh, famously.
Many
a funeral's been ruined.
Speaking of things that will make you want to take your trousers off, we'll be talking about The Legend of Zelda Tears of the Kingdom in the back half of this show, because that's what I've been doing for the past 2 weeks of my life. It was funny last week when Andy was talking to Lucy, be like, oh, Jordan, what are you doing for this the week? And I had to just be like, nothing. Nothing at all.
Contractually, nothing.
Yeah.
Legally, nothing. But before then, we have some headlines, starting off with the next Mortal Kombat game will reportedly be called Mortal Kombat 1. It's been reported that the next game in the series will simply be titled Mortal Kombat 1, according to Bilbil Kun. Is that who we're calling it, Chris? Is that how we pronounce that guy's name?
I believe so. I believe that's the Japanese nomenclature, they believe.
For little boys, isn't it?
Despite being French.
Yeah, I've literally never seen it written down. But according to that, Donnie, who has a track record of uncovering game information prior to the official announcements, the game will be coming to PC, PS5, Xbox Series and Switch, and will simply be called Mortal Kombat 1. This will be the second reboot of the series following Mortal Kombat 9, which also recounted the story of 1 to 3. Chris, how did this hit your ear when this came down the pipe? They've been teasing it for a wee while now.
Yeah, it hit my ear like music, because I'm a big Mortal Kombat fan, but I'll admit that I've kind of dropped over the years and I've totally lost all track of the storyline, which is a shame, because that's arguably one of the best parts about Mortal Kombat these days. But back in the 90s, when I was a Mortal Kombat addict, I like soaked in everything I could about all the characters and all the Earth Realm and the underworld and all this kind of stuff, and just over time just kind of lost track of how complicated it was getting. So if this is a proper reboot back to the kind of the original plot, then suddenly I'm back in the game, literally.
Yeah, and Pete, outside of ripping off the iconic music for the Football Rambles end of show kind of tunes, what's your view on Mortal Kombat?
Oh yeah, big fan back in the day, but I've not touched one since the 90s, John. Every time I bump into like one of those classic kind of arcade Pandora's Box 6s, I'll have a go. I've got one in my back room, and I'll have a crack at that. But yeah, I mean, it's very much not a series I have any great love for. I had no idea there was much lore to it. I know they made a film back in the 90s. I remember Johnny Cage punching Goro in the balls. How many balls do you reckon Goro has? Four? Six? I don't know. It's
you would hope six.
It's probably an awkward number, like three.
Yeah. Yes. He's so arch, that lad. He really is. But I've not touched a game since the 90s, to be honest. And this game series does have a reputation for rebooting quite a lot. They get bored quite quickly and they go, all right, we're going back to the start again. We're making it all up from the beginning.
Yeah, it does feel like Ed Boon is like, I have a really solid first three games in me. And then we'll do the three games and then we'll do some weird shit for a while. And then we'll come back and just start again with your fucking Scorpions and your Raidens. It's weird that... It's also weird, obviously, that this game was announced by some Johnny businessman at Warner Brothers Discovery just being on a crackly phone call being like, yeah, we've got Mortal Kombat 12 coming up. That's going to be really cool.
Do you not think that, like, some games really need leaks? They sort of talk about, like, the new Google phone, the foldable phone, was announced yesterday. So all of, like, the phone manufacturer obsessives on YouTube were talking about this new Pixel foldable phone, and I'm a man who early adopted a Galaxy Fold like a fucking idiot, and so never do that, and so I'm like going, oh, what else is out there nowadays, you know, maybe the tech sort of come on. It's not, it's exactly the bloody same, it's just, you know, slightly better camera as usual, mobile phones go, but they did make the point that, like, some phones need leaks. No, you know, if you are a person who are in the business of leaking, like a Xiaomi phone, nobody cares. Xiaomi needs you to leak. So I think Mortal Kombat needs these leaks, needs these kind of, like, really invested people to make the product bigger than it is. Because apart from, would it be fair to say, Chris, that you know that you're in the minority of still giving a toss about Mortal Kombat in 2023?
Yeah, I'd imagine so. I mean, the fighting genre is one of those things where there's a hardcore who kind of soak up everything about it, and then there's a kind of mainstream who'll only dabble from time to time in your Street Fighters, your Mortal Kombats, or whatever. But certainly if they'd have held on to this until whatever E3 is supposed to be this year, you kind of get the feeling that it would have been kind of
smothered a bit,
with all the other big announcements due that week, or the surrounding weeks. Whereas maybe the kind of Warner Brothers guy mentioning it, and then the subsequent teasers has kind of forced a hand to kind of maybe reveal it a bit earlier than they'd expected or than they'd originally planned, and it might work in its favour, because it's pretty thin on the ground news wise recently. And so now everyone's talking about Mortal Kombat 1, whereas had they held fire like a month and announced it along with every other game being announced, it might have got kind of lost.
Yeah, and Ed Boon also gaslighted a lot of people into thinking he was doing a Marvel game, because he kept being like, I'd really like to do a Marvel game, like a Marvel fighting game, that'd be brilliant.
That's very much The Miz trying to get the lead Johnny Cage role in the new Street Fighter film. I'd really actually quite like, I've been working on my splits. I've gone, yeah, but nobody cares, Miz. Yeah. You're not really an actor.
Poor Mike Mizanin, come on, the real world's own. But yeah, as you mentioned, I don't know if this has been confirmed yet, but the producer of the Mortal Kombat movie retweeted the article that said that Carl Urban is going to play Johnny Cage. Yeah. I mean...
Again, a leak. They need leaks. They need leaks.
Yeah. I actually completely forgot that they'd recently made another Mortal Kombat film. I was like, oh, they're starting the new Mortal Kombat film series. But yeah, Carl Urban's kind of a weird choice. And if you're going to get an actor of that size, obviously it's huge now for the boys and stuff like that. Mm. Is this going to be a Johnny Cage-led film? That sounds fucking insufferable.
He's done a lot of kind of like quite... Carl Urban's done a lot of video game, either video game like Doom, or video game adjacent stuff. Like, he's a proper otaku's otaku, isn't he, really?
Yeah.
if you were ever to lead a Mortal Kombat movie, it has to be Kano. Kano is my favourite character going back to the day, especially because the original Mortal Kombat movie, like the terrible but brilliant one from like the 90s, has one of my favourite lines in any movie ever, and it's not even that good a line, but I used to cite it all the time with my brother. Anytime my brother would come home from school or whatever, we'd kind of always quote it. There's a bit where Sonya's been chasing him for whatever reason, and when the tournament turns up and they're all fighting everyone, suddenly Sonya realises she's got to fight Kano, and suddenly Kano just appears on like the beach ready to fight, and he goes, hello baby, did you miss me? they need to get that line in the next game, and then I'll be sorted.
Carl Urban could do that, because he's so good at that accent, isn't he? I would say with my favourite quote from that film is when when Cage gets his sunglasses squeezed, smashed up by Goro, and he says, "Those are $500 glasses." And as as a kid, I was thinking, I mean, why would you spend more than $100 on some designer sunglasses? You're just going to lose them. And so I've always had this rule because of that film: never spend more than £100 on sunglasses because you're going to lose them.
The other rule is never get Christopher Lambert to say tournament because he just can't do it. He also says enter the tournament. What a film.
I want the next film to be led by Bo Raicho, the real Mortal Kombat hero. And this is how he's described on two separate wikis, right? The first one, Bo Raicho is an outworldian martial arts teacher and a hero from the Mortal Kombat fighting game series. And a much better description, Bo Raicho is a jovial, obese, drunken master of martial arts. That's how I want to be remembered, drunken, obese, nice, jovial master of martial arts. But I'm looking forward to this. I like the Mortal Kombat story modes, they've been pretty good recently, so it's the kind of thing that I'll get that play through it, but my heart's with Street Fighter 6. Street Fighter 6 is going to be the fucking game of, not even the generation, the game of games.
Well, you have to write the guides. June's a bit very busy month for you, John. Enjoy it, mate.
Full move lists, please.
You're not going to fucking play it until September.
It's fine between that, Diablo and Final Fantasy. I'll sneak in a few moments to like have a wash or whatever, but it'll be all good.
I tell you what, speaking of guides and fighting games, I was digging through my old magazines recently and found an old Street Fighter 2 like player's guide from back in the day. And listen, fair play to them the way they did it in the 90s, because for us it's quite easy to do these things in the grand scheme of things, but back then obviously taking photos of the screen to get screenshots and stuff, and they had little combo guides for every character, and every guide had screenshots for every single hit of the combo, so they obviously had to like record it on VHS or something and then pause it and try and get it not flickering and try and get photos of every single hit. That's dedication.
No thanks,
glory days.
Yeah, bring it back. That job's too easy now, if you ask me. Second story, Private Division signs a new action-adventure IP from Pokemon studio Game Freak. This is Take-Two's publishing label, Private Division. Codenamed Project Bloom, the title is expected to release in Take-Two's fiscal year 2026, which ends in March 2026. Although Game Freak is best known for the Pokemon series, it has released a number of smaller, unrelated games in the past, such as Harmonite, Tembo the Badass Elephant, and Giga Wrecker. No, I didn't make those up. Quote, "We are thrilled to have the opportunity to create new IP that is bold and tonally different from our prior work," says Game Freak director Kota Furushima. Quote, "From the beginning, Private Division was the publisher we wanted to work with on our new game. Their track record and global expertise give us the confidence to create a sweeping new action-adventure game that we can't wait to share more about in the future." Chris, Game Freak, they're known for making Pokemon, a series that, despite the games not running anywhere close to acceptably, has stolen the hearts of more people on Earth than any other media franchise. So, what are you thinking about this? This seems like a kind of bigger scope than the previous titles.
Yeah, I'm curious about it because obviously they make their own kind of smaller titles out with the Pocket Men franchise, but it's an interesting one because obviously you mentioned Harmonite, which I love, but also Pocket Card Jockey, which is on the new one, kind of recently come out in Apple Arcade, which I adore that game, but they're all kind of lowish budget, like stuff that they do in their free time, like in between Pokemon games, that some members of staff are allowed to kind of design these smaller projects just to kind of do something different and keep their brains active, I would imagine. But this certainly sounds like it's going to be a bigger budget thing, and it's going to be curious to see just quite what the scale is going to be, and how much that's going to infringe on Pokemon development, because how much resources is going to be needed to kind of be pulled away from Pokemon to work on whatever this is.
That's the thing, it creates a couple of problems for Pokemon. One being, obviously, the new generation just started with Scarlet and Violet, so we won't get any new main series games for like 5 years. That's fine, that's a switch, that's a mid-cycle Switch 2 thing. But obviously they still have to keep up with the DLC, and see if this game comes out and runs beautifully and is like aesthetically flawless, it's just going to turn so many eyes to Pokemon and be like, what the fuck? Why? Like, what is the problem here? Are you being so forced by the corporate machine to get the games out to line up with the trading cards and the anime and shit that you can't make the game fucking work?
Well, do you not think, Jordan, that most of the Pokemon license is just sitting in boardrooms with Pokemon and arguing the toss with lawyers about what you can and can't do with the different characters and just going through the whole game? So, like, that must be the whole job. So you probably have very little time to make the actual video game itself. But on the idea of them doing something that isn't Pokemon, like, this year has been the year of the terrible PC port, and, you know, PC AAA gaming is in the toilet, apparently. If you can't get it running on the Nintendo Switch, your last game, if this game is like a AAA budget, big old departure from what you're used to, working possibly with an unfamiliar engine or some unfamiliar middleware, I hope it comes out on PC, because this has the tendency, this has everything, every box ticked to be the worst PC port of whatever it is, because they've barely made any. Their last PC game, I think, was a game called Tembo the Badass Element, the elephant that you mentioned earlier on. I think that was their last PC port. Like, and it was just like a little 2D adventure game, wasn't it? But like, this could be the worst PC port ever, because look what they couldn't do on the Switch.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, what? Obviously, there's only
Digital
one piece of
Foundry
concept
Digital Foundry shit in their pants at the idea. Their little fucking graphs. Burp. Frame time's gone down to 2 in this scene because they hadn't pre-rendered the fucking... Oh, wow. They're going to have 3 weeks of content out of this.
Alex Battaglia's house explodes when he tries to run it through their fucking frame meister or whatever they do together. Sometimes I wonder, right, I love Digital Foundry. Huge respect to them.
They could easily lie and no one would know.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, it could just all be a lot of shit.
Honestly, when you put this social out, just put a little frame time monitor on the top of this and I'll just go...
Oh, that's my favourite conspiracy of all time. Yeah. That Digital Foundry just makes it up.
Oh, it's like Wizard of Oz, just full of steam. There's just nothing behind it.
Oh, shout out to Digital
Speaking
Foundry,
of Switch ports, though, like, just to go back to Mortal Kombat really briefly, I found it really interesting that if Mr. Bilbil Kun's leak is accurate, that it's coming to PC, PS5, Xbox Series X and S, and Switch. It's like they're skipping the previous gen, so you're stepping down from PS5 to Switch. And obviously the last Mortal Kombat, they did a pretty decent job porting that to the Switch, but it already had like a PS4 and Xbox One version, so the drop down wasn't quite as vast. If you're specifically making a game with new gen, like current gen systems in mind, and then expecting to drop that down to the Switch, I'm going to be really interested to see how, if it kind of maintains the level of quality that the last Mortal Kombat's had.
I wonder if there was a PS4 and Xbox version of this game quite far along and they just binned them off and still did the Switch one, because it was so... Warner's obviously done this before, because there was meant to be a PS4 version of Gotham Knights that got binned off, that got quite far along as far as I'm aware. They released the PS4 version of Hogwarts recently, but it was like 3 months later, and people have done comparisons, and it's quite different in the sense that in the PS5 version, there'll be parts of the castle that you walk outside and you can see the whole open world. They've changed that, so it's all enclosed, so they don't have to load any of the open world. So maybe it's just a case of the Switch version will make enough money to the point where it is worth keeping on, whereas it seems that software sales on PS4 and Xbox One certainly have like absolutely fallen off a cliff. So not much point. And it's not worth everyone making fun of it on Twitter, whereas with the Switch, it just kind of gets the pass of like, oh, it's the Switch, I suppose. But, or it could be one of the streaming ones.
But instead of kind of like having to modify entire levels that you're kind of enclosed and you don't see the open world, why don't you just have a PS4 or Switch hat that your character has to wear? And you only have to render 3/4 of the screen. It's the top. It's just the peak of a baseball cap. And like your overheads are reduced massively.
Yeah, if you cut off vital quest information, who cares? Buy a new console, you scrub. That's how they should treat their old consumers with absolute derision.
You have to wear the PS4 dunce cap of shame if you're playing on that system.
Of a cap of shame, Sony has shut down Concrete Genie Studio Pixel Opus. This was a sad and quite surprising one, and a tweet posted on Friday at the California-based studio wrote, quote, "Dear friends, our Pixel Opus adventure has come to an end. As we look to new futures, we wanted to say a heartfelt thank you to the millions of passionate players who have supported us and our mission to make beautiful, imaginative games with heart. We are so grateful. The studio was founded in 2014 and launched its first game, Entwined, later that year. The game was announced as a surprise during Sony's E3 conference and was made available the same day. It followed up with Concrete Genie in 2019, which won a load of BAFTAs. It was supposed to be working on a PS5 title in collaboration with Sony Pictures Animation, which the status of which we do not know. Chris, did this surprise you? It feels like there hasn't been a kind of, not that this is massive profile, but it's a Sony first party shutting down. Like, that seems a bit out of nowhere.
It's a weird one, because I'll admit I'm not enormously familiar with Pixel Opus's games, because I've not played either of them. But from what I've seen on Twitter, a lot of people are really disappointed, especially given that apparently Concrete Genie was quite well received. So there's a lot of kind of disappointment that they won't get to see what this kind of third project is, which presumably is if not outright cancelled, might have just been kind of totally transformed. I don't know what's going on with that one. But yeah, it's been a while. Obviously, the Sony shut down its Japan studio a while back, and I think more the concern is that it's the feeling is that Sony might be focusing more on the blockbustery side of things, and maybe cutting off some of its more kind of interesting, smaller, more curious titles as a result, and that could result in kind of more third-person action-adventure games and fewer quirky, your kind of Loco Rocos and
Echo Chrome
and Patapon and all that kind of stuff might be falling by the wayside. And maybe Sony's just relying on indies to kind of fill that gap, and they feel that there's less of a there's less need for them to do that, to experiment in that way. But it's certainly a shame when any studio is closed down, especially one that's making kind of critically acclaimed games.
Yeah, it kind of just contributes to the lack of weirdness in Sony's portfolio that's kind of evaporated. Like, Pete, you were alive in the 90s. You were in sweaty rooms ingesting things you shouldn't.
Yeah.
Like, what has been the transition between the way that the PlayStation was originally kind of marketed to, like, oh, you come home from the club at 4 a.m, off your fucking tits on anything and play a bit of Wipeout, to now where it's like, we are the HBO of video games.
Yeah, I guess kind of marketeers probably came from films, didn't they, and television, and came over, and with experiences like that, they just don't want to bother marketing, because with if you to market a game that's like a third person shooter or an FPS or something, you just fucking feed money into the sausage machine and marketing comes out of it. But with games like this, it's kind of like, as soon as a game like this comes out and a company starts pumping out games like this, you do sort of go, right, excellent, beautiful, stunning, very affordable and cost effective ways of creating video games as well. But you do fear for companies that who specialise in this sort of thing, because you're like, TikTok, you've got 2 years and you've got to make a game with a chainsaw, please. It's just like, yeah, it's just because we understand how to market those. It's the fault of the marketers. It's the fault of the PR industry for being unable to market these games, in my opinion. But yeah, you're right. I think the indie, your devolvers are kind of picking up the slack when it comes to that. But yeah, with slightly smaller budgets. Sad, really sad.
Yeah, and it's when Sony was establishing all those kind of weird games, it was in an era where the whole indie game market didn't exist, so there had to be some kind of first party push towards that, whereas now, as you say, like, Sony is probably much better positioned to just pick a few indies and give them a load of cash and just, like, okay, give us marketing rights, stuff like that, as opposed to keeping these smaller scale studios. But I do think Sony needs to, like, at this showcase, which we're not going to chat about because we've chatted about it before, Christ. I think we need one or two Sony first party games that don't look like Horizon or The Last of Us or God of War. It has to give me a fucking random RTS out of nowhere. Give me a fucking a city building game. Like, show that Sony under the Jim Ryan regime is not one kind of game.
What we need is something to sort of infiltrate their company and just delete all the dirt textures. You know, like, to make they'll have a picture of a wall and go, that's not dirty enough. We need graffiti. We need grime. We need mold. Just delete all of those textures. They can't use them, and they'll have to just think a bit more creatively about how they represent their worlds.
Just give me a 15-second teaser that shows Parappa the Rapper's hat.
Yes!
And that's all I need. That's me sorted. That'll keep me going for a couple of years. Kick, new Parappa.
Punch is all in the mind. The final story, Starfield will let you shag. The Entertainment Software Ratings Board, the ESRB, has rated Starfield and has shed some light on some of the game's content. Now, it's probably what you expect. It's guns, it's killing, it's blood. Don't give a fuck about that.
No.
More interestingly, we've got some dialogue after characters quote.
This dialogue is fantastic. Just, this is a warning just for people listening who haven't heard this yet. You're about to hear the lines that are going to
unlock
make up your
sex
talk
life.
In the future.
Give
the
us
following
a John.
Will be performed by Paisley's or trained Jordan Midler. Life is a sexually transmitted disease that's 100% fatal.
Oh, God.
I mean, come on.
Fucking Christ.
I've read that like 20 times and I still don't understand it.
They need to release more trailers. This is a piece of shit.
What is the context? I cannot wait. I'm more excited for this game now than I ever have been. There's so many of them here that's like, I'm all for getting a little wild, but next time let's try it without the jetpacks. Which, does that mean you can pump somebody with a jetpack on? Like
what? And use the jetpack to thrust, so to speak.
Yeah.
Just on and off. Like.
I think the problem is from, I don't know, there was somebody else rated it a while back. I can't remember if it was Australia or someone. And they had the kind of check marks for every category for like sex and violence and drugs and stuff. And under sex, it was like minimal or no sex. So my concern here is that what happens is it's not a Mass Effect situation where you actually see what's going on. It feels like you remind someone and they say, should we take this to the fucking jetpack bedroom? And then it'll fade to black and then it'll fade back with them both lying in bed or putting their clothes back on or whatever. And then they'll say those lines. So although there will be references to jetpack sex, you won't actually see it, which is probably a good and a bad thing.
I mean, it makes it sound like it was classified in Australia, and then the developers went, "Well, we need to bring horny Michael in to write some absolute grot to because it only has minimal amounts of sex." But I mean, talk about seeing stars! Phew, that was amazing. Is one of them, and it's just like. I mean, there's sex in it, but I imagine you only ever have sex with one person and then move on, because they're not having sex with you again after you've said that. They're just not going to.
It's also weird that it's a game that's set in a world where travelling through space is just normal.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't say, like, talk about seeing stars. It's like, yeah, we get it, we're in fucking space. It's not like in real life, if you've had coital interactions with someone, and then the next, when you're getting ready, can you say, well, talk about fucking driving on the motorway.
Yeah.
That was like, talk about going to the shops.
That was out of this world, or you mean the very standard thing that we all do every day? Like, thanks,
that was Glasgow level shagging. It's like we get it, like, it's set in space. Is it like they don't need to talk about seeing the stars?
Space Glasgow. The dream.
Starfield, man.
I'm up for it. I don't usually commit to like big games these days because I just have a lot of free time. But I'm willing to make an exception.
And sci-fi's always cheesy with stuff like this, so it kind of fits. Yeah. If this was anywhere else in the pantheons of fantasy, I think it would be quite, you know, way more poorly received. But I mean, it might be atrocious. The writing might be absolutely terrible.
I'm hoping this writing means it's not taking itself too seriously.
And
is a bit tongue-in-cheek, which would be ideal, because it's the one thing I always kind of had an issue with, like a lot of sci-fi games like Mass Effect and stuff, they take themselves very seriously at times, and I can't really get into that kind of thing. But if this is kind of wink wink, like fucking Indiana Jones in space, then I'm up for it.
But maybe this is like the most polite and kind of normal lines. I mean, it might be like jokes about Uranus and stuff for the rest of it. My absolute shit.
Oh, I hope so. VGC is very pro-space shagging.
Yeah.
Look, folks, we've edged you enough. It's time. After the break, I'll be joined by Gaming Bible's Ewan Moore to talk about The Legend of Zelda, Tears of the Kingdom.
Three, two, one. I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
First dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? My dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
I know why I am here.
And we are back with Gaming Bibles editor Ewan Moore. We've both been down the Tears of the Kingdom mines. Top of the line, Ewan, how are you feeling on the game?
Oh, I think it's magnificent.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, are you a Breath of the Wild guy?
Oh, yeah, very much so. I mean, I know it's one of those, and you've kind of alluded to it before, well, alluded to, and you've been very open about your feelings on Breath of the Wild. For me, it's one of the best Zelda games. It's one of my favorite games of all time. So I was really incredibly excited to see what Tears of the Kingdom did. And I guess we'll get more into this in a bit. But for me, what I love about it, and I think for a few people, this is going to be an issue. But for me, Tears of the Kingdom massively doubles down on everything that made Breath of the Wild what it is. And I think that's going to be a point of contention for a lot of people.
Yeah. So to set it up for people that might not be aware, Tears of the Kingdom, it was announced as the sequel to Breath of the Wild, and they might as well have just called it that because it feels more appropriate than calling it anything else. It's essentially the exact same Hyrule map, but now with some kind of verticality and some depths as well. And the big change here mechanically is that instead of the abilities in the last game, like the bombs and things like that, and the kind of slowdown of time, you have the Pura pad, which I'm surprised they haven't made into a special edition Switch yet, because it looks so much like a Switch. And that gives you the ability to move objects around, stick objects together, jump through like solid objects above you, things like that. And for you, Ewan, when you started to get to grips with those mechanics, how did you feel about them, compare them to Breath of the Wild, that kind of thing?
Well, for a start, I think they're a lot more complicated. They definitely take a lot more getting used to. The controls definitely way more fiddly.
Yeah.
The building especially can really take a while. But I think once you master them, there's a lot more flexibility to do so much more, just in terms of traversal and puzzle solving and just the way you engage with the world. I think it just feels so much deeper and richer because you know, Ultra Hands, that's kind of the big new addition. And it's essentially kind of an advanced version of Magnesis, where you can strap all these random different bits together and see how they work in unison. And I mean, it just completely changed the way I engage with the world. I was constantly on the lookout for different parts to see what kind of things I could build. I mean, I spent about half an hour building what was essentially a rocket ship.
Yeah.
Up a mountain. I could have climbed in about 10 minutes before realizing that if you make a rocket ship out of wooden planks, it's gonna burn. It's that simple. But I, for the most part, love it. I do think that it takes a while to get to grips with, though.
I tend to agree. I think that's the bit, that stuff is the best part of the game. However, and I apologize for being negative so quickly, I think the way all of that controls is actually very, very bad and very fiddly, especially how inelegant it is to like turn things and position things in the way you want to. There's only like two axes of turning, so the amount of times that I knew what I wanted to do with a build, but I was fighting the actual controls to get it to that point, really kind of turned me off. And it went from something where in the start of the game you're in this kind of tutorial zone, like high up in the sky, you've got a couple of shrines to do. And you come to this river and it's basically teaching you, okay, you chop down these logs, you stick them together, it makes a boat, you go across the river when you can't swim that far. And at that point, I was like, this is great, I'm going to fuck about with this so much. And that carried me for a couple hours, but then when it got to the point, especially later on when you unlock some more of the kind of zone eye equipment, so the way that it handles sticking things is there'll be kind of gentle auto lock with the sticking, so it'll stick to a corner, it'll stick directly in the middle, and the amount of times that it would be telling me that it was going to stick to this part of the object, and then I would move it very slightly and it would like fly to the other fucking side of it and it would fuck everything up. That really pissed me off. And I think that's kind of my entire problem with the Breath of the Wild era of Zelda, that the limitations on things like durability and things like some awkward controls, that is what's limiting me having fun with it. And this system's kind of the entire, like, a very good kind of capture of that. Especially when later on, as you say, there's so many puzzles where there is a way that they clearly designed you to do it. However, if you want to fuck about, you can either completely break it or just do it in a completely extravagant way. And I think that's exciting. I just wish that the actual act of putting things together controlled slightly better. Did you have any problem with that?
Yeah, and it was a pain. And it's kind of the same as weapon durability in Breath of the Wild, in that I totally see and agree with this criticism, but my love and enjoyment of the game was enough to override that frustration, which is, you know, undoubtedly a frustration.
Yeah,
I was able to overlook it just because I was having so much fun putting stuff together. And you know, there's the auto build system, which you can unlock a little bit later on, which does make things slightly less of a faff as long as you've got the required parts. But I mean, frankly, it was getting to the point where I just spent resources to build something in auto builds regardless, because it was just so much quicker and easier than faffing around to put stuff together using Ultra Hand.
It's also, I've said this to a few people, I think it's quite funny when you get to a section specifically in the temples where there'll just be like a supermarket shelf of equipment there that's clearly designed to be like, okay, this is the time where you do this now. Where I think it's much more powerful, for example, towards the end of the game, there is something very high in the sky that you have to get to and there's no clear way of doing that. And that's when it's like, oh, of course, I can just build a ship or build a hot air balloon and fly up there. Like, the moments where it's less obvious is, I think it's where it's at its strength. Like, for example, in the early part of Hyrule, there's these guys that are, like, holding up signs and there's, like, wooden equipment next to them. And that bit's basically designed to teach you, like, okay, put something together that will hold up that sign. It's like, oh, that's kind of a cute introductory phase. I couldn't believe that they were, like, all over the map, because towards the last one, I was like, oh, for fuck's sake, mate. Like, come on, I've done this enough times. On that, though, one thing that people were curious about, shrines are back. Are you a shrine believer, or did you fall into the camp that you thought they were somewhat overdone in the first game?
No, I love shrines, and I come from the school of people that play their Switch predominantly like handheld. Certainly when I was smashing through Breath of the Wild back in the day, I was commuting back and forth between Manchester and Nottingham. So having like these bite-sized dungeons, I thought really suits the Switch and the way I play the Switch. So I was delighted to see them back, especially as you kind of mentioned before, they serve like these mini like scrap heap challenges. You just get given shit and it's like, use this to get this ball from point A to point B, and then it's like you say, there's clearly an intentional way of doing it, but by and large the way you achieve your aim in these shrines is fully up to you, definitely more so than in Breath of the Wild.
Yeah, especially because obviously Breath of the Wild had a lot of kind of repeated content down there, and I might be misremembering this, right? Because I've played, it says on my Switch that I've played over 80 hours of this game since we've had it, so it's been a lot, but I don't think I've come across two identical shrines yet. I've done like 40 of them, and by that point, if you've done 40 of them in Breath of the Wild, you've seen the same combat one like 5 times, so like there's clearly an understanding that was a criticism of the first game. But yeah, I like the shrines, and I think it teaches you to think about the mechanics differently, especially in the ones where there's so little kind of instruction as to what to do. It's just like, okay, let me poke around here and see what can go on. I think that those kind of difficult puzzles, I think they could fit a bit better in the game's kind of main content, because I thought all that stuff was really, really simple in terms of what we'll get onto in a minute, the kind of large dungeons. But yeah, the shrines are an interesting one. Once again, the shrines are how you get stamina, how you get health, things like that. All that's the same. Brings me to, a lot of this stuff is a lot like Breath of the Wild, don't you think? It's a pretty similar game. How did that strike you?
I mean, as I say, I adored Breath of the Wild, and I was very excited to see more of the same. One of my biggest concerns, I think, was that Hyrule itself was going to be exactly the same. I think that's true to an extent. I think large parts of it are very much exactly the same, but I also think that there are some surprising and fun changes in the world. Like, you know, the sort of the small way that some of the towns have changed and grown, and the sort of the little pockets of evidence that Hyrule is being rebuilt after Breath of the Wild. And, you know, sort of going back to Tarrytown, which for my money is like one of the best Zelda side quests ever from Breath of the Wild, to go back there and see everything. It's kind of like when I first played Pokemon Gold and went to Kanto, and it was like over 2 years later, and that was so fun for me as someone who spent so long in Kanto in the original games. So to come back to the same Hyrule for the first time ever in a Zelda game, like the exact same Hyrule, that was really exciting for me. Mostly because I spent hundreds of hours in that version of Hyrule. So to come back and be asked to save it, like, I'm not saving it because the game is telling me to. I'm saving it because this is a version of Hyrule that I genuinely am invested in and care about. Now, I totally understand for some people it's just going to be, well, by and large, it's the same Hyrule. And I see that as a criticism. But again, for me, it's kind of, that's one of the strengths for me. Mm. That's what I enjoy about it.
Yeah, I'm conflicted. I think, personally, I think that the sky stuff is a bit underdeveloped, and I was a bit disappointed by, especially after the opening where you spend some time in that tutorial island, I was like, there's going to be so much here. And outside of when you're kind of forced back up there as part of one of the temple quests, like, I thought it was kind of ancillary. I think the depths are a bit more interesting. But yeah, it's weird being in Hyrule again. And it was weird being able to think like, oh, where was that town? And look up a Breath of the Wild map and just be able to go straight there. But it's, so the first thing I did when I got down to Hyrule, I was like, okay, let me go back up to the church from how you start in the first game. And there's like a really cool side quest like hidden in there. So that kind of stuff is great. And it's obviously been thought about in terms of where are the places people are going to go back to like straight away. Obviously the forest and stuff like that is a big part of the late game and stuff, and so it was just someone, I was talking to someone about it, and they were like, it's a bit weird if you're playing Red Dead 2 and you're just in the exact same map, whereas in Red Dead 2 obviously they have the massive map and then you go back to the original map later in the game. And to me, that makes sense if you consider that like the depths, which is underneath Hyrule, and the sky, if they had the same amount of stuff going on as Hyrule, I could almost see that. But yeah, how did you think the whole sky system, like the plateaus and that, were you into that, or did you find it a little bit underdeveloped like I did?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think the way you get to the sky most of the time is more entertaining than what you find when you're actually up there. So for me, I'd see a mysterious looking island in the distance, and I'd spend like 40 minutes trying to cobble together a machine that would get me up there. But yeah, I'd say like 8 times out of 10, what I found when I got there wasn't nearly as interesting as the experience of getting up there, because it's usually the same kind of robot-y construct boss.
Yeah.
Or a shrine, which, you know, is fine and it's a good reward. But yes, I was expecting the sky to play more of a role than it ultimately does. So that is a shame.
Yeah, it's strange, especially when you open the map and you flick to like the sky part of it. You're like, there's really not a lot here. And if you discount stuff that is just shrines, like there's barely anything up in the sky. As far as the depths though, like I have not explored anywhere near all of the depths, and that's really exciting, especially the first time you go down there and it's like so pitch black, it's like actually unsettling. I don't know if they talked about the depths pre-release, but it was a complete shock to me. Like I jumped down the first chasm and I was like, oh, this is going to be like an instant death, or there's a few areas in the game where if you go before you're supposed to, it like turns you back. I was like, oh, this is clearly late game stuff. And then I went down right to the bottom of it and I was like, this is genuinely unlike anything in Breath of the Wild. What do you think about the depths?
I love the depths. I think that's so cool, and it feels like properly, like you say, unlike anything in Breath of the Wild. It feels properly alien and just dark and horrible and inhospitable and just full of some real nasty monsters. Like I accidentally stumbled into a Gleok lair the other day, like came up on the map like Gleok nest. I was like, no. And I think that's where a lot of the building stuff is more useful. It's certainly like, you know, putting together like a sort of Land Rover type vehicle, stick some lights on it so you can actually see and just sort of navigate your way forwards across what is mostly quite rough and toxic terrain. I think it's excellent, and I do every time I go down there end up spending a couple of hours just sort of trying to navigate my way from point to point to sort of light it up and chart the area as best I can.
I thought it was kind of interesting as an answer to a Breath of the Wild criticism, because there's a lot of people that rightly point out that in Breath of the Wild there is no reason for you to die, because you can carry a ridiculous amount of food, you heal instantly, like all of that stuff. If you have enough hearts, like you're basically unstoppable. Whereas in the depths, you can take permanent damage that lasts until you leave the depths, so you can get down to like one heart if you step on the wrong area, and that comes into play kind of later in the game. But yeah, I thought when I went down there, I was like, it gave me Minecraft vibes, weirdly. It was like when you go spelunking in Minecraft and you're really far from your base and you're like, I bet you there's some good stuff down here if I can just make it back. And there is, like, you can get really high level weapons really early in the game by going down there, but the enemies are significantly tougher. So I thought that was really, the stuff in the depths was the kind of stuff I was hoping for from the sky, because you can essentially ignore the sky after a certain point, whereas you want to revisit the depths.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting about the sky is that one of the main things you find up there are maps that lead you down to treasure in the depths.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like the only point of the sky really is to take you down to the depths. So it's kind of crazy that they didn't make a bigger song and dance about that part of the map, because it is, I would say, infinitely more interesting than up in the sky.
Yeah, it's so when I was exploring down the depths, I didn't realize it at the time, but I stumbled upon basically the last main quest you do before you go and do the last thing, and I was just like, what is this big like porcelain temple that I can't really do anything in? And there was this like thing in the middle of it. I was like, I'm sure I'm supposed to do something here. And then you come back, and that's actually a good transition. I could not believe it when I played this game and they were like, go to the four corners of Hyrule and recruit these people, I was like, are you taking the piss? Are we seriously doing this again? Are we going to the exact same tribes? One of the first things you'll get told to do is investigate regional phenomena, and that leads you to the game's main dungeons, which are similar to Breath of the Wild in the sense that they are tied to a specific kind of AI companion who will assist you on that dungeon, and then once you're finished you can summon them. What did you think about these? Did you think they were better than the kind of the boss fight style dungeons in Breath of the Wild? Like, how did you come across these?
I think that the abilities you get from the sages are nowhere near as good as these you got from the champions in Breath of the Wild. I think the dungeons still aren't quite up to what I was hoping for from, you know, I was hoping for a return to like really traditional Zelda dungeons, and I thought these temples would be the things to deliver it. They kind of come close. They're certainly better than the Divine Beasts, if only because they're all thematically distinct from one another, which I really appreciated. And I think the bosses are much better than just your sort of variations on the same Ganon. A step in the right direction from Breath of the Wild, but still lacking what I think a lot of traditional Zelda fans are craving from those challenges.
Yeah, I also think it must be really hard to design something like those dungeons if the entire kind of ethos of the game is we are going to give you the tools to break it. Like, as soon as you let players jump through solid objects above them, like, you can, it completely throws certain like platforming challenges out the window. The amount of times I've felt like there's been like a little lip on a corner of something that I've just managed to go into and completely skip like parts of the game. And obviously you could say, well, that's what they want you to do, but it does make some of the content feel a bit cheap if you can so easily circumvent it. I like the one, there's one where you're like rearranging mirrors to shoot a light and stuff like that, and it's like, okay, that's a bit of lateral thinking that I can't really cheat my way through, which I appreciated. But some of them seemed a bit, they were a bit like, one of them is literally just flip like five switches around this ship, and I thought getting up to that point was really fun and really kind of challenging, but then when we actually got there, it wasn't so good. The boss fights are good, like visually they're pretty spectacular. As you mentioned, the sages become AI companions after you complete those challenges, and you can turn them off if you want, and they almost serve as like difficulty options, because see, once you have all of them together fighting for you, like, it makes the game so easy. And I almost, like, obviously we won't discuss the last boss or anything like that, but it felt like it was designed to have all of them. Like, it almost becomes like this Musou fight when there's so many enemies and things like that. So yeah, it was a bit strange. Did you like the sages as characters? Did any of the storylines from those regional phenomena like do anything for you? Because I thought that were, I don't think this game has a very good story, but I think it has good writing, if you'll follow me. I think there are like, I like the dialogue between the characters. I like going into the towns and chatting to people and be like, oh, this is interesting, it's quite funny, but the overall what we're doing, why we're doing it, it didn't really work for me.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think it is more successful on a story front than Breath of the Wild. That is not the highest bar to I would say. I really like Prince Sidon, you know, the Zora prince. I think he's great, and sort of catching up with him again after Breath of the Wild was great fun. I suppose my issue there is, out of the four sages that you sort of meet and recruit, only one of them is kind of actually someone you haven't met before.
Yeah.
The others are guys that you've worked with in some capacity in Breath of the Wild, and it's nice to see them again, but it's kind of like, well, we could do a little bit more to change this up than, you know, working with the exact same people as last time.
There are flashes here where you can totally see how this started as a DLC and blew well out of proportion. Like, you could see the sky section being added to Breath of the Wild and very little changing. But yeah, I think it's an interesting one that will be the topic of conversation for the rest of the year. I can't see anything else coming out to kind of top this. I wish this game came out the same year as Elden Ring, so I think that'd be a very enjoyable game of the year fight. But yeah, it's been such a weird experience. It's not a shame, it's a very privileged position to play these games early. However, I wish I could just show people all the stupid shit that's been happening while I've been like building stuff, and they blow up and I fly off in the wrong direction because I've misbalanced the rockets and all that stuff. Like, it is a It is a clip factory. But Ewan, you better get back down the mines. There's probably a million other things you've not done yet in the game.
Oh yeah, I mean, God help us all, especially you doing the guides, man. You have my sympathy.
Yeah, I'd be surprised if most of them are in actual English by the end of this weekend, but we persevere. I'm not doing the Korok seeds. I do not care. I do not get paid nearly enough to do the fucking Korok seeds. They'll do everything else.
Do not look away. You witness a king's revival and the birth of his new world.
And we are back. Chris, as Johnny Nintendo, as Mr. fucking
Jonathan,
Mario...
That's Jonathan Nintendo to you.
Sorry, I thought we were on friendlier terms. But Mr. Nintendo with your fucking Mario and Luigi curtains, where is your excitement level for Tears of the Kingdom, and how angry are you that a scrub like me has played like 80 hours of it?
Interestingly, my excitement level is obviously palpable. But at the same time, I'm kind of glad that I didn't do this one. Because
oh, really?
Sorry to say, because I remember doing Breath of the Wild back in the day, and I was kind of freelance at the time, and was fortunate enough to kind of to be trusted to review it on my own site, which I still don't really understand to this day. But even then, like, I didn't get to finish it in time because it was so big, and the review kind of had to kind of blatantly explain that, by the way, I didn't get to finish this, but it's amazing. That shit doesn't fly when you're writing for like a proper website, and just the way my life is just now, we've spoken about this in the past in podcasts, like, as a 40-year-old man with a child who writes books now, I don't have the time to absolutely whore out Zelda in like 2 weeks and get it all turned around. Like, you say in your review, you've put 80 hours into it already. Like, I've not had 80 hours to scratch my balls.
Did you not see that advert with the man on the bus? Did you not see that advert?
Yeah.
That's you, I could
take
playing it without headphones, the big fucking nonce.
look at Sky and like sigh dreamily.
Why didn't he have headphones on? He's like blaring out.
Everyone else in the bus is just hearing like going,
He's getting that twocked. He's having that taken right off him.
But it's yeah, that kind of sigh at the end of that advert as well. Like, it's not just like a normal. He looks out at the sky, and the sky isn't drab anymore. It's now a nice vibrant blue.
And talk about out, and seeing kind of, stars.
There's like a weird, like, satisfied sigh. He kind of goes. So people behind him on the bus are like, all they can hear is, and then I'm going. It's like, oh mate, fucking get that off. But yeah, what I was trying to say was that I'm looking forward to it, but obviously I need a period of like of an empty schedule before I buy it, so I won't actually be getting it this week, because I'm just, it's only going to cause problems if everything in my life gets kind of put aside for Zelda. It's just going to create massive actual work backlogs later, so I'm going to save it until I've got a kind of a big journey or a big trip or whatever, and then I'll get it and absolutely rinse it.
I had to be saved from myself. I was talking to a friend of the show, Blessing Adeoye Jr., about it, who has reviewed it for Kinda Funny, and I was like, yeah, I've been fucking about, I'm here. And he's like, mate, you need to play the main quest because you've got fucking loads to do. I was like, shit. Because it's so easy just to sit and fuck about. Like, it's a really, it is an ultimately fuckaboutable game, which I really appreciated. But yeah, it's mad. It's mad having so few people to talk about it. And now, when it comes out tomorrow, that is
you've
all
still
Twitter
wait.
Will be.
But you've still got to wait until people have got to the point where you have, or done as much as you have, surely.
If it's anything like the first game, like, we are going to be Zelda, like, all over Twitter for, like, months and months and months to come. Like, people just making ridiculous things with this Ultra Hand gimmick.
It's Kerbal Space Program, isn't it?
It's going to be
Kerbal Log Program.
I asked on Twitter for people's favourite Zelda memories, and I'll obviously open this to the panel, but Chris Wall says, it blew my mind as a kid when I learned, question, Epona or Epona?
I would say Epona.
Yeah, because it's a pony. You don't call it.
I'm pretty sure that's what they had in mind in Japan. Yeah.
It's a pony. Yeah. At Lon Lon Ranch, and the song is how she remembers you when you return as an adult.
Speaking of something like that, one of my pals from Coatbridge back in Greater Glasgow, for those not familiar with it. You know that horror film Insidious?
Mm.
Uh-huh. Insidious that came out. And the guy said, have you seen the trailer? Because I review horror films and that in my kind of free time, or at least I used to. So I've got people back home who like know me as the horror film guy, even just now. And my pal, like when that first came out, saying, you seen the trailer for that new film, Insidious? It looks brilliant. I says, ah, it looks good. He says, it's a clever title. It's a, because it's about when it comes up in the trailer, like Insidious, and you think and you go, oh, it actually means the monster is Insidious. I'm pretty sure that's not what Hollywood is thinking.
Lovely.
Oh, I love that. Insidious.
Insidious.
Rob Saunders, who has a bit of experience with Nintendo, says, playing Link to the Past for the first time, nothing like it. Wandering through the foggy forest to retrieve the Master Sword for the first time was great, but nothing was as crazy as travelling from the light to the dark world. It's weird, like, Zelda games seem to have this. I assume it's the age you encounter them is why Zelda gets so many people hot under the collar, but they all have these very whimsical, like, oh, I was walking through this area and this happened, whereas the first Zelda game I ever played, Wii version of Twilight Princess, and I was like, why are people so into this? First of all, it was the Wii version, so obviously people say play the GameCube one, but yeah, my Zelda like come to Jesus moment wasn't until I played Wind Waker, and I was like, oh, okay, this is the fucking this is the one. Chris, you got a favourite Zelda moment?
Mine's just really boring and predictable. It was like the Hyrule Field in Ocarina. It's like I had the first Zelda on the NES and Zelda 2, which is massively underrated. A lot of people don't give that the love it deserves. And obviously Link to the Past, Link's Awakening. But when you leave the forest at the start of Ocarina and go into Hyrule Field, and suddenly you're like, and in hindsight when you look back, it's fucking stupid, because it's probably the size of a football park. but when you go out and you're like, Jesus, this is the biggest open world I've ever seen in my life, and it probably fits in one block in Grand Theft Auto now. But you're like, if I walk over there for 90 seconds I can reach a farm, but if I walk over there for a further 120 seconds I'll reach a castle. And despite that, like, you can't walk from one to the other without it turning dark like loads of pricks coming up and fighting you. So for me it's the very boring and predictable scene Hyrule Field for the first time and going, games have changed forever. Like a proper nod.
Pete, you're a Zelda man?
My only experience before the last one on Switch was N64 emulation in, like, what would it have been, late 90s? Yeah, kind of like 99, 2000. I didn't have a particularly fast computer, so that was an absolute nightmare. And I just thought, nice. I don't know what this is. It's just too... this is too complex and too big to be playing on a system that just will not run it. The last one was... I was a little bit like Lucy, who was on the show last week, in that I found the last game just too unfocused, and I got stuck on the same thing over and over again, fighting the same enemies, crafting the same stuff, and working on my same kind of spells and stuff, and I just couldn't find the time to actually invest in getting past it. So I just found it very unfocused. So I put a lot of hours in, and a lot of flights, a lot of bus journeys and car journeys and stuff, but I just couldn't get past this bit, and I was just like, I just had other things to do, really. I don't know why I find the Far Cry games easier. I just find them more focused and more viscerally satisfying. Like, the map seems smaller and there's a bit more variation, maybe. I don't know. So yeah, it's a very unpopular notion to say that the Far Cry games are better than Zelda. But no, that's why talking. You're hearing it. You're hearing it here on the VGC podcast.
That's VGC approved. Like, I've been on a worldwide tour for the past couple of years saying that Breath of the Wild isn't as good as people fucking bang on about it. So you're right. You're right here with me, brother.
Yeah. So in hindsight, you were the perfect guy to review.
If I fucking was, because you'll read so many reviews today that are just like people who spunk over Breath of the Wild 24/7 and refuse to look critically at that game, which
and don't even use a jetpack.
Exactly. Talk about seeing stars. The problems with Breath of the Wild were so obvious that in Tears of the Kingdom, Nintendo specifically fixed them mechanically. So
right.
Jordan was right. Thank you very much. Thank you, Amsterdam. Good night. Fucking Anuma agrees with me.
Game as a service just for Jordan. With reviewing a game like this, Jordan, this, because video, until I started getting involved in this podcast, I'm not sure I realised how insanely tribal the different fan bases are for an unlovable bit of fucking silicon. Like, it's just insane. Yeah. Absolutely mental stuff, right? Maybe I'm just a bit older, a bit wiser, or I just don't fucking care because I'm normal. But, like, the things you have to do, the contortions you have to sort of make or even think about making to get a really pretty simple point across in a review, words that will get extrapolated, discussed, shouted down on socials by Nintendo fans, by Zelda fans. Like, it must be so different to reviewing a game 10 years ago, even just 10 years ago, than now. I work on football podcasts, I work on a wrestling podcast, I work on a podcast about Japan, and my job is very much to be a dickhead. Come on, tell a dick joke and then fuck off, right? But with video, obviously being a video game critic, like, you have to be so much more circumspect than you were even 5-10 years ago. I do not envy having to review a series so beloved for such crazy people.
Yeah, you just kind of have to make sure that what you say is unimpeachable and that you can defend it, because you know that if you leave anything in a review that you're not completely tied up about, that you don't have the justification for, that'll be the thing that's quoted on fucking some sweaty wee podcast for the rest of time on YouTube, like, with a thumbnail that's like, oh, games critics go woke over Zelda. There's a very famous one that happened to IGN over a Pokemon review like 10 years ago at this point, and the thing that people quote from that review wasn't even in the written review. It was in the summary at the end that wasn't written by the writer, but that still follows them around,
because it's just
one mistake, one inelegant wording, and it's so easy to be inelegant because we have so little time to get this right. You're not fucking spending a month on a review. Like, you could be spending, like, you could write a review and it has to go up in a couple of hours, so you just have to be very good at fucking doing it. But it's
without being without producing a homogenized product, I suppose. I hate your job.
And it has always been difficult, but obviously, like, just social media and YouTube and stuff makes it harder. But even, like, going back to where I started, like, we didn't review Pokemon Battle Revolution on the Wii, an official Nintendo magazine, and it was purely because the code came in so late.
Yeah,
and the lead times and magazines are so crazy that by the time the review would have come out, it would have been like a month and a half too late. And obviously, Sod's Law, it ended up being a pretty average game. And obviously, the conspiracy theories were that we deliberately didn't print it to save Nintendo's blushes and stuff. But back then, I mean, all our scores get criticised then. But the thing was, back then, they just came in emails that could easily be ignored, and they were just as pathetic and just as banal. And it was obviously because, like, it was because the official Nintendo magazine, a lot of our readers were a bit younger, so you'd get reviews, you'd get emails in going, I can't believe you gave Ace Attorney 87%, and then there's like 400.
Was that Andy Robinson?
It was 400, 500 words about.
Always a south of the border accent when you're doing an idiot, aren't you?
It goes like 400, 500 words on why I was wrong and such a prick, and it goes, you gave 87. It's easily worth 88, and then you'll have to delete, and then you just move on with your life.
Right.
But it's always been. I remember criticising magazine and review scores from the 80s and 90s, but yeah, certainly the social media and YouTube just makes it far more and vicious, and people don't forget stuff, and it's always like no matter what score you give a game now, people have got a catalogue of reviews to compare it with. Just waiting. So you say, you gave this a 5, but this fucking review from 7 years ago that was written by a completely different person, you gave it a 4.
And try and review anything on Xbox without seeing my Plague Tale review and the replies. Be like, oh, man, you gave Plague Tale a fucking 2 stars. That's clearly a fucking game of the year.
And you got to remember, like, you know how your, is it your cells replace every 4 years? In video game journalism, there's a whole raft of new people every 6 months. So it's kind of like, so you've completely replaced.
It's weird though, because VGC is so tight knit and it's just the four of us, and primarily it's just me and Chris reviewing stuff. Like, it's one of the rare websites where you can actually go back and be like, oh, for pretty much every big game on this side of the table, it's me, and on this side of the table, it's Chris. So you can like very directly compare it.
But then, not to extend this podcast out needlessly long, but like, I think IGN put a video out this week of them sort of saying, right, why don't you review the games that, why is everything a 7 out of 10? Like, because there are 13,000 fucking games that come out every month, and we've only got a review. What they were saying was that it makes sense for them to review the ones that people are talking about, people are excited about, people that are trailed, people that are market, you know, games that are marketed to them, right? What they should have said was, like, if I don't review a big game, you're not going to fucking... you don't care my opinions on Power Simulator. You don't care about PC building simulator and stuff, like the East Germany kind of games. Like, it's kind of like, we have to review the big hitters, and they invariably are a homogenised pile of 7 out of 10 every single time.
Yeah, that video, which has now been deleted, was... a misstep, in my opinion, but the reason that, like,
I didn't watch all of it. I just saw a bit of it.
I think without dwelling too much on it, I think the overall point they made was a fair one, and probably one that we would go along with. But certain things said in that video were extremely wrongly expressed, and it's been rightly deleted. Yeah,
That's why VGC likes to explore the scale. I love giving a game 2 out of 5. I fucking love it.
It's better to give a game a big old boot, innit?
Honestly, see, if you give a game a 7, that's a fucking coward score, because, or rather an 8. No one gets annoyed at an 8. See, unless it's a fucking top tier game, no one fucking blinks an eye at an 8. See if you're in the trenches. See if you're saying Gotham Knights is actually alright, like I fucking did, then you're really fucking suffering.
I would recommend anyone who thinks we overscore stuff as a rule, I would politely suggest they go back on VGC and look for my review of Bullseye on the Switch. One of the worst games I've ever had the misfortune of playing. A darts game where you can't throw the darts accurately.
Lovely.
R.I.P. Jim Bowen.
Yeah. God rest him.
He once went on the breakfast show that I was working on and said some things about gypsies.
And then Billy appeared and went,
before this gets entirely Peter K, you can send your questions, comments and concerns to podcast at videogameschronicle.com. Fuck knows what's going on next week. I don't think I'm reviewing anything between now and next week. God, I hope not. So next week we'll have a bit of fun and lightheartedness before the June, which probably kills me. Thanks for listening. You can follow myself on Twitter at Jordan Midler. Tell me how incorrect I am about Zelda. Chris at Scully1888 and Pete at Pete Donaldson. We'd like to thank the great Grant Kirkhope for the VGC podcast theme song. Say goodbye, Chris.
Goodbye, Chris.
Say goodbye, Pete.
Garlic darts!
Remember as well, life is a sexually transmitted disease and it's 100% fatal.
We hope to be seeing stars with you soon, and we'll see you next week.
VGC, a video games podcast, is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces 3 thought-provoking questions over 3 glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit. And he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast snook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.